This time of year is often spent with the ones we love. It's a time for conversation, connection, laughter, and the comforting chaos of shared traditions. But for some families, this time of year is a reminder of heartbreak and unanswered questions. So for today's true crime episode, we will be focusing on two unsolved cases. These are the perplexing stories of John Woodruff and Karen Mitchell. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Perplexity and Mystery Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Kadra. If you're new to the show, hello and welcome. I tell tales every single week that have perplexed me. So if you love a good mystery that leaves you wanting more, don't worry, you're in the right place. And if you end up enjoying today's special True Crime Thanksgiving episode, I would love if you continue to follow along. If you are a returning listener, hello, my friends. Welcome back. So happy you're here. I've put together a great episode for you guys today, and we're going to go over some important cases. But very quickly, since we're at the top of the show, I would like to welcome my newest patrons. Thank you so much for joining the Perplexed Society, Bobo Jenkins. And thank you also for editing your pledge up. I would also like to welcome Arthur, who is a Perplexity supporter. So Arthur's going to get early and ad-free episodes, and Bobo is going to get tons of bonus content and some stickers. Both of them will also get welcome letters. So that really helps the show. It's been really exciting to get new patrons over the last several weeks. So thank you guys so much. You have no idea how much that helps the show. It costs a decent amount of money to keep this show up and running. So thank you very much. If that interests you, you guys can always go check out patreon.com/perplexitymysterypodcast. I do want to issue a trigger warning for today's true crime episode. Listener discretion is advised, and all the sources used for today's episode will be available down in the show notes. So first, let's get into the case of John Woodruff. For this case, we are going back 106 years ago. A 32-year-old New Yorker named John Howie Woodruff would vanish in the early morning hours of Thanksgiving in 1919. John was born in Towanda, Pennsylvania on May 9, 1883, to parents Jared Ferris Woodruff and Jane Howie Woodruff. John came from a really big and active family. He had 8 siblings. And throughout his younger years, he dealt with multiple tragedies. From a young age, John unfortunately became very familiar with death. First, John lost his mom when he was just 4 years old. Later, he lost his oldest sister, Jessie, when she was only 16. Several years later, when John was in his early 20s, he lost his father in 1904. And when John was in his mid-20s, he lost one of his other sisters, Bessie. So obviously this would be really difficult for anyone to deal with, and after experiencing a great amount of loss, and with John entering into adulthood, he decided it was time to forge his own path and have a fresh start. He decided to relocate to Schenectady County, New York. Schenectady land was originally the land of the Mohawk tribe of the Haudenosaunee Nation, and beginning in the 17th century, European immigrants started to flood in. Irish refugees came during the Great Famine. Schenectady was very attractive to a lot of people, including John, because of its industrial jobs. In fact, Schenectady was an industrial powerhouse, a center of innovation, with the headquarters of General Electric and the American Locomotive Company. The city was once known as the city that lights and hauls the world. So John shows up, and Schenectady is booming, with about 90,000 residents. And he's looking forward to getting a good job, settling down, hopefully meeting a woman, and starting a family. And sure enough, soon after John settled into Schenectady, he met Mabel Primmer. The two quickly fell in love, despite their 11-year age gap, with John being the older of the two. And they soon got married on September 20th, 1916. John and Mabel quickly started a family. They had 2 kids, Ferris and Ruth, and they settled in the small town of Scotia, which is part of Schenectady County. For a little while, John worked at a real estate job with J.A. Lindsley, and it was a good job, but it's not really what John wanted to do. He really wanted to do something in the outdoors. That's what he had always been passionate about. And in this area in New York, there are a lot of woods. So there were a decent amount of people that started to become interested in being game protectors or game wardens. John was looking forward to working outdoors, being around wildlife, so this was perfect for him. He was a rugged, 6-foot-tall marksman. In fact, John had recently won a shooting competition. Game protectors were becoming popular in New York, but they were fairly new. They had been operating for just a couple decades when John would join the force. They were part of the police. In 1880, Governor Alonzo B. Cornell appointed 8 game protectors originally to serve in the Fish and Game Division of the State of New York Conservation Commission. The game protectors were part of a growing national effort to protect the declining fish and game populations. New conservation laws were being passed every year, and with these new laws came the need for enforcement. But obviously, this was not a very easy job. Hunters were not used to being told what to do. Before this, it was essentially the Wild Wild West. Hunters could go around and kind of get away with doing whatever they wanted. So this was not going to be an easy job. It originally started with these 8 men in plain street clothes, and they were also assigned to patrol nearly 55,000 square miles of New York State. So this was very daunting and also would prove to be dangerous. In 1899, Governor Theodore Roosevelt, one of the nation's earliest proponents of nature conservation, took a big interest in the game protectors. Roosevelt would declare that he wanted, quote, "men of courage, resolution, and hardihood, who can handle the rifle, axe, and paddle, who can camp out in summer or winter, who can go on snowshoes if necessary, who can go through the whole woods by day or by night without regards to trails." So the game protectors soon became a force to be reckoned with. They grew to 131 uniformed men by 1919, and this was the year that John would join. At this point, the game protectors had built quite a reputation for themselves as the new enforcers of authority. They also built a substantial list of enemies, aka hunters who didn't like being told what to do and what to kill. On the morning of Sunday, April 5th, 1914, just about 5 years before John would disappear, another game protector named Samuel Taylor would be gunned down by local hunters. Samuel was also young like John. He was 38, he was from Buckville, New York, and he had been patrolling the banks of the Mohawk River in the city of Rome, searching for illegal duck hunters. So he's on patrol, and Samuel hears the sound of gunfire. So obviously, he goes towards it, moving deeper into the thick New York woods, and he finds several men illegally shooting robins. Samuel was with a couple other game protectors, and they confronted these hunters, informing them they were under arrest. Just then, one of the hunters, carrying a shotgun, would fire twice into the game protectors' group. They struck Samuel in the chest and abdomen. And shortly after midnight on April 6th, 1914, Samuel Taylor would succumb to his injuries, making him the first New York game protector to die in the line of duty. And unfortunately, he would not be the last. 2 local suspects were apprehended for Samuel's murder, but then they were questioned and released, and no one was ever charged with Samuel Taylor's murder. Why, I could not tell you. So flashing forward to late 1919, John Woodruff would finish first on the civil service exam. He was then appointed by New York State Conservation Commissioner George D. Pratt on November 1st, 1919. During his brief career as game protector, John was said to be hated by other hunters. He was very zealous in his prosecutions of men caught violating state law. In other words, he was good at doing his job. At 7 a.m. on Thanksgiving morning, November 27th, 1919, John Woodruff would say goodbye to his wife Mabel and his 2 kids, Ferris and Ruth. Mrs. Mabel would say she was really worried each time John would go into work because John had already stacked up a good number of enemies and he had been receiving threats. Just before he disappeared, John got a threatening letter. He opened it and he read it in front of Mabel. According to Mabel, the letter made several threatening statements, such as, "I'll get you and I'm not afraid of you." But John was a marksman. He was a 6-foot-tall, rugged outdoorsman. He thought all this was ridiculous and he really was not taking these threats seriously. He also didn't want his wife, Mabel, to worry. So he tore the letter up in front of her and was like, "They're not gonna get me, don't worry about it." But when he left for work that Thanksgiving morning, Mabel was worried. She hoped he would return home for Thanksgiving dinner. But instead, John Woodruff would seemingly vanish into thin air. When John didn't return from work that evening, Mabel would contact the authorities. An investigation started quickly. After all, John was part of the police force. The search involved men from the Scotia Police, other game protectors, deputies, the state police, which had only just been founded a couple years prior, and even the Boy Scouts helped in the search. The group would search the woods of South Schenectady and other neighboring counties like Gilderland and Carmen. But after several days of searching, the search was called off because there was absolutely no trace of John. The local newspaper also released some articles about John's disappearance, but no calls came in and the case ran cold. Mabel and her two young children were devastated and left with no answers. After about 1 year since John had disappeared, investigators got their first break. A witness, a 21-year-old man named Fred Ferradino, would come forward with a statement to the DA. Ferradino was a young immigrant from Italy. He lived nearby in Rotterdam, and he claimed that at about 11 a.m. on Thanksgiving Day in 1919, the morning that John disappeared, Ferradino had been in the waiting room of the local railway near the 9 Mile Bridge and Lock Number 9. Ferradino was waiting for a trolley when he overheard an argument. So he turns and he looks and sees two rugged outdoorsmen arguing back and forth, and one of them he believes was John Woodruff. The other one was a hunter that he didn't recognize. The hunter had a shotgun around his shoulder, and the argument was getting more and more heated. He overheard the man that he believed to be John telling the hunter that he was going to be arrested for the illegal hunting of ferrets. The only thing that Ferradino really said about the hunter, other than the fact that he had a shotgun, is that he had some type of accent and appeared to be foreign. Next, according to Ferradino, these two men left the station and they headed towards the woods. The hunter said that he needed to go into the woods to get his dog. Police believe this may have been some type of ruse to get John Woodruff to go into the woods with him. The two continued arguing, and then the hunter fired his rifle twice into the air. So other people think this could have been to get his hunting dogs to come towards him, but I have a theory about this that we'll talk about later. Other reports from witnesses who claimed to have seen John Woodruff the day he disappeared had conflicting accounts, though, with Fred Ferradino. I couldn't find these particular sightings. The only one I could find was Fred's account. But there are sources that say whatever these people saw, it conflicted with Fred's account. And so Fred Ferradino's sighting was ultimately discredited. So John Woodruff is gone. And now a year has gone by. It seemed that there could have finally been a promising lead, but then it didn't pan out. I can't imagine how distraught Mabel Woodruff and her children must have been. Then another year went by and several more months. On April 3rd, 1921, there would finally be another break in the case. George H. Barrett, a railroad car repairman and a New York Central employee, was hiking through the woods hunting arbutus. He was in the area that was then known as Johnson Farm, near Amsterdam Road, NYS Route 5, near the 9 Mile Bridge. This was about a quarter mile from the state road and 9 miles from the city. So George Barrett comes across a partially buried skeleton. The remains were badly decomposed, with two gold teeth covered in slate stones and pushed into a small and deep hole in the bed of a creek. This creek was dry most of the year. The slate stones were stacked with incredible precision and neatness, almost like a makeshift tomb. The remains would later be identified using dental records. This was John Howie Woodruff. He was found 16 months after he had disappeared. Like I said, there had been no leads at this point, so John's case had basically been closed. The discovery of John's body would result in the case being reinvestigated. Game protector and confidential inspector Delbert Speenberg was quickly assigned to the case. And when analyzing John's body, it became clear to Speenberg that John's skull had been smashed open. This was no accident. John had been murdered. John's hunting boots, clothing, a gold watch, his Conservation Commission ID, some Conservation Commission papers, and a holster for his gun, a .38 caliber revolver, were also all found near his body. Gun cartridges were also in John's pocket. But John also had some items that were missing. His .38 caliber revolver was not in the holster. And his badge was also missing. Perhaps this was in an attempt to conceal his identity, but his Conservation Commission ID and his papers were also with him. The gun and his badge have never been found. The local coroner determined the cause of death was a blow to the back of his head. The coroner concluded John had been murdered. The coroner believed the blow was likely from the butt of a shotgun. Spienberg also went undercover for a while, working with a suspect who had gone to Canada. But this lead dried up and ended up being a dead end. And once again, the case of John Woodruff would go cold. John was buried at the Vale Cemetery in Schenectady. His family was deeply impacted by his murder. This was at a time that women tended to be at home and not working. So for Mabel, having to support herself and her two kids while dealing with the unimaginable loss of her husband was very difficult. Mabel got a monthly stipend of $50 from the Conservation Commission, which is about $800 today. This was not enough to support the family, and she lost their house. This would have also been around the time of the Great Depression, when hundreds of thousands of American citizens were losing their homes. Finally, over 20 years later, there would be another break in John's case, prompting the state police to take another look. Two men spoke to the FBI in Buffalo on February 7, 1947. These men claimed their stepfather had confided in them that 20 years ago, he and someone else had murdered a man in the woods. This was in the same area where John was found. Their stepfather claimed they had done this because a game warden had attempted to arrest their stepfather for illegally shooting a bird. This definitely sounds promising. If this story and Fred Ferradino's sightings are true, it makes me wonder if the stepfather was the one arguing with John at the train station and lured him into the woods, where the man helping him was lying in wait. Perhaps the shots that the stepdad fired were warning shots to the other killer, and John wouldn't have expected there to be another man in the woods. He could have easily snuck up behind him and struck him over the head with the butt of his gun. According to the two sons, their stepdad also cruelly bragged about tying this game warden to a tree, leaving him to die of exposure. There was a snowstorm in the area at the time. This lines up with weather that year. In fact, because of this snowstorm, police initially thought that John may have just gotten caught in the snowstorm by accident, and perhaps his remains would be found in a snowdrift. The men also claimed that their stepfather later returned to the tree and would kill the victim, shooting him in the head with a shotgun. This would indicate at some point the men returned for John and buried him in the creek with the slate stones. When later interviewed by investigators in 1947, Inspector Delbert Spienberg, who had originally handled John's case, would say it was possible a portion of John's skull had been shot away by a shotgun. Forensics obviously was not very good back then, and his remains were quite decomposed. They had been in the elements for some time, so determining exact cause of death was difficult. So basically, a blow to the back of the head was obvious, part of the skull had been crushed. It's possible this was from a gunshot wound. So, with all of this information from these two men regarding the stepdad, investigators got to work and they were able to track down this stepfather. He was still alive. So they interviewed him, but allegedly, they were able to discount the story completely. Additionally, one of the stepsons would allegedly later say they had made this entire story up in an attempt to get their stepfather out of the way due to some type of family dispute. Are we serious? If they made this up, that is so ridiculous, and I feel like they should have gone to prison for false reporting. This case is incredibly frustrating. There's multiple times where you think it's about to get solved, and then they're back to square one again, and I just feel so bad for John's loved ones. Investigators also once again would interview Fred Ferradino, the one who said he thought he saw John at the train station. They even showed Fred a photo of the stepfather. However, Fred claims this was not the man that he saw with John at the train station. But what I'm wondering is, what if this unknown second man that was allegedly helping the stepfather in the murder, what if he was actually the one that was arguing at the train station with John, and it was actually the stepfather that was lying in wait in the woods? Neither of these two suspects have ever been identified publicly, so there's really not a whole lot of information. The district attorney also pushed to exhume John's body for further examination. But unfortunately and very frustratingly, this request was denied because there was apparently not enough evidence. So, to this day, the murder of John Howie Woodruff remains unsolved. All we can really do is speculate and hope that someone will come forward with solid information. At this point, everyone involved in this case is dead, so I'm surprised someone hasn't talked. Many years later, in the early 2000s, a new rumor about the case would surface. The rumor goes that a man from Glenville confessed to his wife that he was the one who murdered John H. Woodruff. This man has never been named, and he has since passed away. No evidence has emerged to corroborate his story, but I'm wondering if this man was the other man that was involved, based on what the two children had told police. Sadly, the killing of game protectors did not end with John. In 1929, another game protector named William Kramer from Queens, New York, was murdered by a shotgun blast. He and his partner, Joseph Allen, were attempting to arrest songbird hunters along the shores of Jamaica Bay when Kramer was gunned down. The men were sentenced to prison in Ossining, making this the first time that one of these game protectors was murdered and there was actually some semblance of justice. John's wife Mabel never remarried, and she passed away in 1970. Mabel and John's children, Ferris and Ruth, are also now deceased. So all of these people passed, not getting answers. John H. Woodruff is listed in the police memorial in Albany, and he's been commemorated through ceremonies at his grave in recent years. It's truly a heartbreaking story, and such a senseless murder over something so trivial. I hope that one day this case is able to be solved, but for now, who was responsible for the murder of John H. Woodruff remains a mystery. Now, for this next case, we are going to the West Coast and flashing forward another six decades. 16-year-old Karen Mitchell of Eureka, California, would disappear. Karen Marie Mitchell was born on November 11th, 1980. At the time of her disappearance, she was 5'5", 130 pounds, with sandy, blonde, neck-length, straight hair, fair skin, greenish-blue eyes, and pierced ears. She was wearing a tan long-sleeve shirt, baggy brown corduroy pants, tan leather shoes with buckles, and she had several pieces of jewelry on, including a silver necklace with a crystal, three silver rings, and small hoop earrings. She was also carrying a Nalgene water bottle. Karen was loved by many. She loved to laugh, she had a tenacious advocacy for the environment, and a great love for her family and friends. She was known to be a very caring, opinionated, and smart individual. Karen was an excellent student. She had liberal views and was passionate about politics, especially when it came to the environment. She also loved working with children. She had high goals for herself. She planned to graduate early from Winship High School and attend Humboldt State University, where she was going to either study law or poli-sci. She went missing on Thanksgiving Day, November 25th, 1997, in Eureka, California. She had just turned 16. That Thanksgiving morning, she had actually been filling out her college application over the phone with her mother. They were talking about how cool it would be to take college classes together. They were super excited to see each other for the holidays soon as well. Karen had actually been living with her aunt, and she would come home and visit her mom and her brother during the holidays. Karen's aunt was a woman named Annie Casper. Annie was Karen's legal guardian. Karen's parents had divorced not long after she was born, and in her early childhood, her mother was a single mom. So raising Karen and her brother alone just became too much. As heartbreaking as it was, she didn't think that it was right to keep Karen, but she remained close with her. So when Karen was 13, she moved in with her aunt, Annie, and Karen's mother also thought that Annie's home was a safer area for her to live in. At the time that Karen Mitchell disappeared, she had been living with Annie for 3.5 years. Annie owned a shoe store inside the Bayshore Mall, and this was just 1 mile from where Karen did volunteer work. Annie would later tell authorities that Karen had stopped by the store briefly around 2:45 p.m. on the day that she disappeared. She helped her aunt at the store with a couple of things. They talked for a while. Everything seemed totally normal. When Karen left, she said she was headed to work. Her aunt offered to give her a ride, but it was just 1 mile away. It was a really nice sunny day. And so Karen told her aunt not to worry about it. So Karen Mitchell was last spotted walking towards West Sonoma Street. When Annie would later go to pick Karen up from her job, Karen was nowhere to be found. Confused, Annie went inside to talk to Karen's coworkers, who informed Annie that Karen had never shown up for her shift. Karen never missed work, so Annie immediately knew something was wrong, and she called the police. A search team canvassed the area, and as the sun set that night, Annie thought of her niece's vivid fear of the dark. She thought about how terrified she must be out there alone and hoped that they would find her soon. But of course, this would not happen. There were absolutely no signs of Karen. Family members and local volunteers put together a massive search effort. Additionally, Karen's friends were helping. At Eureka High School, they were passing out flyers. There was a candlelight vigil held for her in the school gym. Detectives from the FBI, Eureka Police, and the Sheriff's Department investigated all potential leads. One report claimed that they believed they had seen Karen at a swimming hole in Grass Valley. There were also some other sightings, which we hear about a lot in disappearance cases. But none of these sightings could be substantiated. So ultimately, it was like Karen had just vanished. As time passed, cadaver dogs and search rescue personnel combed the area, thinking that Karen had likely died. But nothing was found. The phones at the information center also stopped ringing, and the case went cold. Karen's family thought there might have been hope for a short time several years later, in 2001. After a young female responding to the name Karen turned up all the way in Arizona, but it turned out this was not Karen Mitchell. So one major theory in Karen Mitchell's disappearance is she was met with foul play and that this was possibly done by a serial killer. A couple of witnesses told authorities on the day Karen disappeared, they saw a girl fitting her description. Enter a light blue four-door 1976 to 1978 sedan, which was probably a Ford Granada, a Mercury Monarch, or a Nissan. The descriptions of the vehicle varied. The vehicle had a California license plate, and the back said Eureka. The driver was a white, older male, 60 to 70 years old, and he was very small in stature. He was balding with either light gray or blonde hair. He wore eyeglasses, his eyes were greenish or gray, and he had a very large nose that appeared to have previously been broken. He was wearing a long-sleeved, button-down, light blue shirt, and this witness claimed that this driver went across Broadway Street really quickly. He was driving recklessly to pick up Karen, and he nearly hit this witness because he was driving so insane. So it makes sense that this witness would remember this person. At this point, whoever was driving this light blue car then stopped the vehicle, and the girl that's believed to be Karen went inside. This description by the witness would later be matched to a man that I was already well familiar with, alleged serial killer Robert Durst. So if you guys have not heard of Robert Durst, I watched The Jinx years ago on HBO. It's a series about Robert Durst, and I feel like Karen's case is not talked about enough, so I wanted to highlight it in this episode. I'm not gonna go into tons of detail about Durst. We'll talk about him a decent amount, but if you wanna learn more, I would recommend you watch The Jinx because it is absolutely insane. There is, in my opinion, strong evidence that supports the theory that Karen Mitchell was kidnapped by Robert Durst, allegedly. There's just too many coincidences. For example, Robert Durst went to Karen's aunt's store several times in March 1998, just a couple months after Karen disappeared, so he's inserting himself, in a way, in the investigation. There are also uncorroborated, but rumors that Robert Durst was known to shop at Annie's shoe store while Karen was still alive, and that it's possible Karen may have even met Robert Durst when he was disguised as a woman. If you don't know who Robert Durst is, you're probably like, what the fuck? But Robert Durst was known to wear disguises. That was one of the things that he often did. He would dress up like a woman sometimes. So he was like a serial killer version of Mrs. Doubtfire. It's also rumored that Durst volunteered at the same local homeless shelter as Karen. So another possibility that he would have met her. He lived close by in Trinidad, which is 25 miles north of the Bayshore Mall where Karen was last seen. I couldn't find anything about what kind of car he drove at the time. And of course, these are just rumors, but what really gets me is the description that the witness gave of the suspect. This led to a sketch. Robert Durst was balding, older, he was very small, he regularly wore eyeglasses, he had a big nose, and when you look at the sketch, which I'm gonna put on Instagram and in the YouTube video, it is uncanny, in my opinion. Durst also has a very suspicious and disturbing past. When police suspected Durst as having been involved in Karen's disappearance, they started digging into him. And this is before we knew who Durst was. They discovered Durst's first wife, Kathleen, had disappeared very mysteriously way back in 1982 in New York. But of course, rumors, a similar-looking sketch, and his wife mysteriously vanishing were not enough evidence for any type of conviction with Karen. And Karen's remains have never been found. But let's flash forward with Robert Durst. A couple years after Karen disappeared, Robert Durst faced serious legal charges. In 2001, he was charged with the murder and dismemberment of a man named Morris Black, and this was all the way in Texas. Robert regularly traveled. At this point, we're in New York, we're in California, we're in Texas, and in this time period, it would be very easy for him to get away with multiple murders. This is just ridiculous to me, but Robert Durst claimed that this murder of Morris Black was out of self-defense, and he was acquitted in 2003. I'm sorry, but I don't understand how you can dismember someone and claim self-defense. Someone make that make sense to me, please. More recently, in 2015, Robert was charged with the 2000 murder of his dear friend, Susan Berman. So obviously, at this point, it's not looking good that 16-year-old Karen Mitchell was possibly last seen in Robert Durst's car. But obviously, at the time Karen disappeared, investigators didn't know about Morris Black or Susan Berman. Robert was also a suspect in the 1997 disappearance, the same year Karen disappeared, of a young girl named Kristen Madaffery from San Francisco. Kristen was 18, she was a student from North Carolina, and she had been visiting the Bay Area for the summer. One suspect in Kristen's disappearance also fit Durst's profile, particularly for the cross-dressing and prowling around homeless shelters. Another pretty strange coincidence. However, police in the Bay Area felt they did not have sufficient evidence to pursue Durst. Robert Durst has also been investigated in regards to the 1971 disappearance of 18-year-old Lynn Schultz from Middlebury, Vermont. Robert and his first wife, Kathleen, the one who disappeared, owned a health food store in Middlebury in the 70s. Lynn regularly went to this store, including the day that she went missing. So, to me, when you look at profiles, when you look at pictures and ages of Kristen Madaffery, Lynn Schultz, and Karen Mitchell, they all have a similar victim profile. They were young, they were around college age. Karen Mitchell also looks eerily similar to Robert Durst's wife, Kathleen, and Lynn Schultz. One investigator, John Bradley, interviewed a woman who was incarcerated in San Francisco, who had lived in Humboldt County when Durst lived in Trinidad. The woman was named Shelley, and she had been arrested on drug charges and sex work. Investigator Bradley had a hunch that Shelley might know something about Karen Mitchell. Shelley claimed she didn't, but she did have some interesting things to say. First, when she was shown a picture of Durst, Shelley said that she had seen him around Eureka frequenting homeless shelters, including the one that Karen volunteered at. In regards to Durst, Investigator Bradley has said, quote, "His comfort level with killing is so secure. He kills strangers for practice, then people directly connected to him, and he just doesn't worry about discovery," end quote. In 2021, Robert Durst was finally convicted for the murder of his close friend Susan Berman, and he was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. He was also charged with the murder of his first wife, Kathleen McCormick. However, shortly after his sentencing, Durst died from cardiac arrest before a trial could even begin. Eureka police have since handed over Karen Mitchell's case to the Humboldt County DA's office. Interestingly, Dave Paris, a detective who worked on Karen's case from 97 to 06, claims detectives initially ruled out Durst as a suspect because it was believed he was out of town at the time Karen went missing. But I couldn't find anything else about this. But if this is true, who else could be responsible? Another suspect in Karen's case was a trucker named Wayne Adam Ford. In 1999, Ford walked into the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office with a woman's severed breast in his pocket. He confessed to the murders of four women in the area, saying he had dumped their bodies in four different counties after strangling them for sexual gratification. His brother is the one who convinced him to turn himself in. Wayne also feared if he didn't confess, he would eventually murder his ex-wife and leave his child an orphan. Detectives were considering Ford as a suspect in Karen's disappearance because he had a history of murdering women who hitchhiked. However, he doesn't seem to have a profile that would make sense with Karen. He was known to kill women who didn't have homes and who were in sex work. But Ford did confess to killing and dismembering a woman just 1 month prior to Karen's disappearance. This woman's torso was also found in Eureka in October 97. Police did question Ford about Karen's disappearance, but he denied having anything to do with it. He also took a polygraph test and passed it. Not that that means anything. Karen didn't seem to fit the profile of Ford's victims, but it's possible that he could have been the one to do it. We've known with other people in the past that they break that profile sometimes and they kill people that seem random, sometimes for practice. And I mean, this is a similar theory with Robert Durst. David Walker, a detective who worked on Karen's case, told the media 20 years later, it was still hard for him and the other investigators to even talk about Karen. This was a very upsetting and disturbing disappearance. There's always something about losing a child in the community that's especially heartbreaking. In 2012, an age progression photo was released of Karen Mitchell. This photo will be available in the YouTube video and on the Instagram page. The age progression was provided by the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. And as of 2018, Karen's old room at Annie and Bill Casper's home in Eureka was still referred to as Karen's room. And at this time, we know that Annie Casper was also still running her shoe store. Annie told the media that locals still would come into her store and talk about Karen. They spoke about how wonderful she was and how they hoped for answers. The Karen Mitchell case has garnered national attention throughout the decades by journalists and private investigators, but all of these leads have ended in nothing more than speculation. Karen's mother, Mary, would say nearly 20 years later, quote, "Every day, I think about where she would be if she would have a family. What would her job be? How our conversations would go? How much fun we would be having? The trips we would take," end quote. During the time of that interview, Karen's family was still fighting for answers, and they had put out a $10,000 reward. That was the most recent information that I was able to find. November 25th, 2025 will mark 28 years since Karen's disappearance. No arrests have ever been made. For the 20th year anniversary of her disappearance, Karen's mother Mary also went hiking with her sons James and Andrew, and they planted a tree along the trail in Karen's honor. Mary still talks to Karen often, saying she will always remember her as a free spirit treating the world with kindness, and loving the life that she was given. I think that's a lesson we should all receive. If you have any information about the disappearance of Karen Mitchell, you are urged to contact the Eureka Police Department at 707-441-4044. And this information will also be available down in the show notes. And that, everybody, is the story of the disappearance of Karen Mitchell. This holiday, remember to cherish your loved ones. Be safe and be present. Enjoy your time. Thank you, everyone, so much for listening to today's episode. I hope you guys enjoyed it. If you did, be sure to let me know. If you are watching on YouTube, you can like this video and drop a comment down below. Subscribe. I want to hear what you guys think about the disappearance of John Woodruff and his murder. What do you think about Karen Mitchell and these theories of who could have done it? And also, I want to hear from you guys what you want to hear next. Season 3 is going to be coming to an end very soon, which is crazy to think about. The 3-year anniversary of Perplexity Mystery Podcast is coming up in just about a month as well. So if you guys have requests for season 4, if you have listener stories you want me to read, anything mysterious or true crime related, you can send those to me, perplexitymysterypodcast@gmail.com. And just continue to tell people about the show. I'm very happy that I'm getting patrons now to support the show. That's super helpful. And the show's starting to grow, which is amazing. So word of mouth goes a long way. If you have a mystery lover in your life, share this show with somebody. And if you haven't yet, please leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify. It really, really helps. That boosts me up the algorithms and helps me get new listeners. So thanks, everybody. You all are amazing. I hope you have a great week. Please stay safe, and I will talk to you next week. Bye. Perplexity, a Mystery Podcast, is hosted, written, and produced by me, Kadra Brannon. This show is proud to be a part of the Black Cat Network. Assistant editor is Charlie Leopold. Assistant producer is TJ McRae. Theme song by Patrick Thompson. Music for this episode is from Pixabay. If you enjoyed today's episode, leave a 5-star review wherever you get your podcasts. If you have a story to share or a topic request, email perplexitymysterypodcast@gmail.com. Contact, support, and merch links can be found in the episode description. And you can always unlock early and ad-free episodes and exclusive bonus content by joining the Perplexed Society at patreon.com/perplexitymysterypodcast. Until next week, stay curious.